Hi, welcome to the Consciousness Revolution Show. You're listening to your host, my name, Haroon Rabbani, and this is another one of our fantastic interviews with another amazing, amazing person. I'm here live from the Oracy Studios in London, and I tell you what, so much is happening in the world of consciousness, you wouldn't believe. There's famous scientists from all over the world coming to London and presenting, and people who are not so famous. However, from within the UK, we're seeing a growth of British homegrown talent. Many of these individuals are terribly humble and just get on with the business of helping people transform their lives, which is really what it's all about, right? Now, on today's show, I have one such guest. That's Dr. David Hamilton. David came as a great talent. I mean, when I saw David, he was a great talent to watch out from. That's what people were telling me. And not just anybody, but, you know, some highly regarded scientists were saying to me, you know what, David Hamilton is one of our up-and-coming British talents. And you just got to interview him. And so this is exactly what I'm doing right now today. Now, before we start the show, before I start interviewing David, what I'd like to do is just remind listeners from all over the world, wherever you are, if you're listening on the web, there is a question and answer section on the website. So you can type in your question, ping it across to me, and I will put it through to David. Just make sure you type it across. Make it as interactive as you can. Because this show isn't about me just interviewing and having a conversation with David. It's about you. And no matter how many times I've said this, I'm going to say it again. If you listen to the show and do nothing about it, you have been entertained. If you listen to the show and take action on it and start transforming your lives, you have been educated. So welcome to the Consciousness Revolution Show, David.
Thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Thank you. David, I mean, you were mentioned to me by one particular person to start off with, Dr. Jude Curvin.
Amazing woman.
She is absolutely phenomenal. I've read all of her books, and it's just mind-blowing. Now, she said to me, you know what, David's a scientist, he's an author, and he's got a great reputation of helping transforming lives. So when I had the chance to see you in Birmingham at a workshop, I absolutely loved everything I heard, because not only did you explain the science, but you also explained the real everyday application of it. Mm. So thank you for that. Let's talk a bit about your background there before you started doing the work that you're doing now. You started out as a pharmacologist. Hopefully said it correctly, for a major pharmaceutical giant. Now, what was the work you were doing there, David?
It wasn't so much pharmacology. It was more like developing drugs. I helped to build really drugs for cardiovascular disease, which is heart disease, and also for cancer. And you know, I did that for 4 years after my PhD. But what fascinated me more than actually making the drugs and developing, you know, what developing drugs is you turn a drug, an actual, you know, a conglomeration of atoms stuck together, you turn that into a medicine, and to do that you combine it with lots of other ingredients to make up the whole product, which is pharmacologically active. And so I really enjoyed doing that. But what was more interesting to me is that when we tested the drugs on people, you know, to prove that the drug works, that's where the power of the mind came into play, and that was so fascinating for me. You know, we would give 100 people a drug, and then 100 people would get a fake drug of what many people know as a placebo. Now, fake drugs are often made of blackboard chalk or even sugar or a combination of the two.
And
and it's not uncommon for, you know, 100 people, out of the 100 to get the drug, for 80 of them to get better. But it's not uncommon to have maybe 50, 60, or even 70 get better on the blackboard chalk, purely because they believe that they're actually getting the drug. And for me, that was far more interesting than actually working, developing, building drugs.
So tell me about the placebo effect, because we just briefly touched upon it before the interview. What proportion of drugs actually are just purely placebo rather than, you know, having any real effect on people?
Well, just about every drug has a biological effect. And by biological effect, what I mean is, if you take this drug, something happens inside the body. So just about every drug that you can take has some kind of effect. But the placebo effect is often very, very high. I mean, sometimes it's quite small as well. And this placebo effect can be so strong at times that it can mask out the effect of the drug and make it look like the drug doesn't work. For example, with many of the world's leading antidepressant drugs, and even some leading heart drugs. The placebo effect, you know, is in the 80s, 80 over 80%, and it can make it look like the drug doesn't work at all, just purely because the mind has such a high effect upon it.
Wow. Wow. I know. I actually read somewhere, actually it was one of our other guests, Dr. Dawson Church,
yes.
In his Genie in Your Genes.
Wonderful book.
Yeah, he talked about, I forget the name of the antidepressant now, the famous one, Liverpon. He said there was a research done which actually said that 96% of the effect was purely placebo, the antidepressant, which is absolutely mind-blowing.
It's absolutely incredible, and what this actually shows is the power of the mind is far, far greater than the average person would expect, you know, far, far greater.
Right, absolutely. Now, you moved from the pharmaceutical industry into the kind of work that you're doing. I mean, first of all, what work are you currently doing, and why the move, why the change?
Well, most of my work now is writing books. I mean, I spend several months a year reading through, you know, several hundred medical journal papers and neuroscience journal papers and pharmacology papers and psychology papers as I research for another book. At the moment I'm trying to write a book a year. And not so much trying to make that goal, but just I find the stuff so interesting that a book a year is roughly what's coming out of me.
Well, okay.
So I spend several months researching the stuff, and then a few months actually pulling it all together and writing it. And throughout that time and for the rest of the year, I really tour around the country, sometimes over in the States, just giving public talks and full-day workshops as well.
That's right. And what's your current book which you'd like to share with the listeners right now?
It's called Why Kindness is Good for You.
Okay, which
Why
is actually
kindness is good for you.
The topic of tonight. So, tell me, as a scientist, now you talk about kindness in your book.
Mm.
Surely you can't really seriously measure kindness and compassion. I mean, isn't that the realm of more like touchy-feely, happy people?
You would think.
You would think.
But there's actually there's incredible amount of evidence now growing that shows that when you're actually experiencing, let's say, a state of compassion, that you actually cause changes in the chemistry of your brain. If you're doing an act of kindness, then not only do you cause a change in the chemistry of your brain, but you actually release hormones into the bloodstream that have a very, very powerful impact on your heart. So the kindness and compassion are now moving into the realms of what you call measurable biochemical changes within the body. You know, just experiencing these states actually leading to real, hard, factual, easily measurable changes in the biology of the body.
So you can actually measure the changes you're seeing?
Oh, absolutely. You know, even just to take compassion, for example, there was a study that taught a Tibetan Buddhist a Tibetan Buddhist meditation practice, which is known as a loving kindness compassion meditation. And basically what that meditation is about is helping people to feel a sense of compassion, so that they'll actually go through a list of people in their mind, starting with their closest loved ones, and then they extend that on to people that they just know. Then they extend it on, if they can, to their enemies. And basically they wish each person happiness, well-being, and a relief from all of their suffering. So that's the compassion aspect of it. And now studies are showing that if a person does that meditation regularly, neuroscientists are measuring structural changes in the brain. And what that means is the brain, many of the cells in the brain, they actually sprout new connections between them. And these are called neural connections. So if you think of a brain cell as a tree and another brain cell as a tree, then what's happening is the trees are actually growing extra branches purely on account of experiencing this state of compassion.
So what does that mean? What does it mean in real life? You know, you're changing the physiology of the brain, but on a day-to-day basis, if someone's physiology changes, what does that mean in real life?
What it translates to in real life is actually two main things. The first thing that it does, when you get these structural changes in the brain, which actually take place in the front part of the brain just above the forehead, particularly on the left-hand side, and what that does is it helps people to feel a greater sense of empathy, a greater sense of positive emotions, a greater sense of positive well-being in their life. So basically, the average person performing this kind of meditation regularly just tends to feel better for, you know, you could even say for no apparent reason, but just feeling generally warmer, happier, more positive, more optimistic with their life. The second thing that happens is that the area of the brain that's developed through this compassion meditation, that area of the brain is actually partly responsible for a person's capacity to concentrate upon things and to pay attention. So what happens is you have an improved capacity to concentrate on and to pay attention, and that could translate into advantages really in any aspect of your life, particularly, let's say, if you work in a business environment. Having an improved capacity to concentrate and paying attention is going to produce many, many rewards for yourself.
So tell me, on a day-to-day basis, where you mentioned business now, a lot of our listeners run their own businesses or they're working.
Yes.
Now, in this high, heavy, competitive environment, what's the general feelings that they would have? You know, this is before any kind of meditation is done, any kind of work that you recommend is done. What happens to the emotions? You know, you talk about the amygdala, don't you?
One of the things that happens through, let's say, regular acts of kindness or regular acts of compassion, is we produce a hormone in the brain, and that hormone's called oxytocin. Now, many people are familiar with the name of that hormone because it's been known for some time now as the hormone that's involved in childbirth. So oxytocin can induce labour, providing you're pregnant, of course.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah. And it also causes milk production in when a woman's just given birth as well.
Right.
But one of the things that oxytocin does, and bear in mind that oxytocin is produced when you show regular kindness or compassion of the sort that involves a personal connection with someone. So you do something kind and you make eye contact. So for a moment, for a second or more than a second, there's even a tiny connection between the two of you. It might just be a smile. But that connection produces oxytocin in the brain. And one of the things that oxytocin does is that it moves to a part of the brain called the amygdala, which in many people is responsible for feelings of, let's say, fear and anxiety. It can be active at times when we're mistrustful of people and things. And what oxytocin does is it literally turns down the activity level of that part of the brain, of the amygdala. What that actually means is we become more trusting of people. We become more generous towards people, more gentle even towards people. We even like people more. And it's funny that there's actually businessmen in some places around the world who are buying oxytocin from the internet and spraying it in the boardroom because it improves, you know, before
really?
an investment meeting, because it improves trust between different individuals. I don't know how ethical that actually is.
Well, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Maybe it's a debatable subject, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's fascinating. I mean, so where can I get this oxytocin, by the way? No, I mean, all of my listeners are great, absolutely.
Actually, on the internet, it's called Liquid Trust.
Really? It's actually, okay.
Yeah, honestly, if you type oxytocin, O-X-Y-T-O-C-I-N, oxytocin, you Google that, one of the sponsored links should be Liquid Trust.
Wow.
People buy it, yeah. I mean, but to be honest, you don't need to spray it because you generate it yourself when you're shown kindness or caring behaviour towards someone. In fact, even when you give someone a hug, you produce very high levels naturally of oxytocin. Just giving or receiving a hug does exactly the same as spraying it in the atmosphere.
Could that be, okay, being a drug or naturally or otherwise, could that be addictive?
What would be addictive is the way that it makes you feel. So therefore, you would become addicted to taking it, not because the oxytocin itself is addictive, but because the way it makes you feel is addictive. And what it's causing is other changes in the chemistry of the brain. You're producing natural addictive substances in the brain. So it's not so much the oxytocin itself that's addictive, but the byproducts in the brain and in the body that become addictive.
Now, when I was at your workshop, you talked about effects of oxytocin on many other areas. What else can you share about oxytocin?
Oh, do you know, some of the most amazing research around has only just came out in the medical journals over the last year, and it shows oxytocin's incredibly powerful impact on the heart. or what you would call the cardiovascular system, which is the system of your veins and your arteries and your capillaries as blood pumps out, blood and oxygen are pumped around your body, the cardiovascular system. What happens is a oxytocin, when it's actually released, not only from the brain, but also from the heart. The heart manufactures it itself, and it begins to pump around the bloodstream. And what it does is it binds to the, it sticks to the cells that line your arteries. Now, to get a picture of this, imagine that you've got tiles on your bathroom wall. Now, right. Imagine on the inside of your arteries, like a rubber tubing, imagine you've got rubber tiles on the inside of that, like bathroom tiles. Now, on the inside of your arteries, veins and capillaries, you have tiles like that, and they're actually called endothelial cells. And right. What happens is oxytocin sticks to them, almost like glue, and it causes them to produce nitric oxide. Now, nitric oxide, not to be confused with nitrous oxide, which is laughing gas. Yeah, produces nitric oxide, and what nitric oxide does is it dilates the arteries and veins and capillaries. What that means is it expands them, and when it expands them, your blood pressure comes down. So oxytocin, in a sense, in a very, very direct sense, lowers blood pressure. So scientists are now referring to it as a cardioprotective hormone, because it is protective towards your heart, your cardiovascular system. And that's only one of the simple ways that it impacts the heart.
So what you're saying is then, for those people who had high blood pressure, maybe because of stress at work, maybe because, I don't know, they're slightly big or something or whatever, one of the best things for them to do is what? Be more kind and more compassionate.
Yeah, as touchy-feely as that might sound, the scientific evidence is incredibly powerful that if you, do become more kind and caring and compassionate and hug people more and just I often say to people, be gentler towards people, be friendly towards people. It's well known now in science that the richer our social networks are, in other words, the more social connections we have of a sense that we would offer each other emotional support in times of difficulty. So not just how many, Facebook friends or Twitter followers we have, but how many actual people that we have in our social circle who we would offer support for in a difficult situation, or they would offer support for us. The richer our social networks in that respect are, the more oxytocin we tend to have in our bloodstream, and the healthier our hearts generally are. Yeah, so what I often say to people is, get good at friends, one, but just become softer and gentler towards people. It takes a lot of courage to do something like that, but it's very, very healthy for you and also healthy for the person that you become friends and that you offer support for as well.
So, how do you encourage someone, say, for example, who is perhaps shy or maybe they've got somebody in their life, could be a father, could be somebody important in their relationship, could be a boss, who's generally a grouchy person. How do they deal with somebody like that or maybe they themselves are grouchy generally, and I can think of one or two people. my dad, actually.
Yeah.
How do you convince somebody like that, hey, by the way, when you're more kind and generous, your life, your health, everything will change?
Well, aside from thrusting a copy of my book into their lap,
available at all good bookshops, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Aside from doing that, in a bit kind of fun way, you can wear people down with hugs. I've worn down my entire family with hugs. They didn't used to be hugging people, but I think over the years I've insisted upon giving them hugs every time I visit, so to the extent that they really enjoy that as well. But on a more serious note, it is sometimes difficult in difficult environments, but sometimes all you can actually do is change your own behaviour. It's difficult to change someone else. And when it comes down to making any change, whether it's in your life, your working environment, the change always starts with ourselves, with looking at ourselves and being honest with our own behaviour and the way in which we really act, the way in which we really communicate, and being absolutely brutally honest with ourselves. And if there's any changes we can make to our own behaviour, then that's where we start. And what you'll find often is when you start to make subtle changes in your behaviour, which in this sense might be an introduction of more gentle behaviour, more kind behaviour, more patience, more honesty, more trusting behaviour, you know, anything of in the family of behaviours which you would call kindness, then you might then find people changing around you. Not because you've tried to change them, but because you have changed yourself first. And the byproduct of that is people change.
Absolutely, 100% agree. So, I mean, we're talking about kindness, but share with our listeners what happens to somebody who's maybe not producing too much oxytocin. In other words, they're not very kind. What actually happens to someone who's constantly stressed, working in a high-pressure environment, and actually not taking, you know, care of themselves?
Yeah, well, looking specifically at the heart, I talk quite a lot about the heart because when I worked in the pharmaceutical industry, that was my specialist area, was drugs for cardiovascular diseases. And the heart is also the organ of the body that's most powerfully affected by kindness, but also most negatively affected by high amounts of stress and even high amounts of hostility and aggressiveness. And what happens when a person's under chronic amounts of stress for a long period of time, the reason why it affects the heart, the reason why people take heart attacks, it's the stressful, the feeling chronic amounts of stress, and even if a person was, you know, aggressive or hostile, you know, all of these things, they produce two phenomena inside the body. The first is because, as well as stress hormones levels come up, two main things happen that contribute to heart disease. The first is free radical production, and free radicals get produced as a side effect of lots of stress. They could also be a side effect of aggression, aggressive tendencies. They're also a side effect of too much fried foods, drinking too much too often, smoking too much. You know, basically what we define as lifestyle abuse of our bodies. We produce free radicals. The other phenomenon is inflammation. Now, inflammation, many people are familiar with inflammation. If you cut yourself and the wound becomes inflamed. Now, the inflammation is actually a vital part of the healing process. Right. But inflammation takes place also on the inside of the body, quite often on the inside of your veins and arteries and capillaries. We just can't see it. Some scientists refer to it even as the dripping tap, if you like, and you don't know that it's happening. But it's also a byproduct of, you know, stress. A byproduct of lots of stress. It can be a byproduct of aggression, aggressive tendencies, also a byproduct of diet, poor dietary choices, smoking too much, etc. The same kind of things that produce the free radicals. Now, if a person's chronically stressed for a period of time, the rise in free radicals and the rise in inflammation directly contribute to heart disease. And that's why chronic amounts of stress are actually pretty bad for the heart. And that's why, similarly, aggression and hostility, when you become, your behaviour is regularly aggressive and hostile towards people, it has almost the same effect, if not greater, over a period of time than chronic amounts of stress. And these have almost the same, and sometimes more, effects, negative effects, than even having a poor diet or poor lifestyle. It's funny how we have to add, you know, thinking and feeling and stress and the mind effect, the mind and emotion effects to the overall heart disease equation because of the rises in these free radicals and inflammation within the body.
So, I mean, what about, I mean, people who live in situations where they're constantly in a state of survival? I'm thinking of maybe living in urban regions where they're constantly having to either look for work or they're out of work, ghetto type environment. What about
people?
I mean, what happens to people like that?
Yeah, I think that everyone's got their own individual environments, and some environments are really, really stressful. And I guess that we all in life have our own individual challenges, and there's never a one-size-fits-all, really. But what I find is everyone within their own environment has to find a way themselves by saying to themselves, okay, this is my environment. It's maybe a lot more difficult than someone else who has, you know, a really nice, positive lifestyle. My environment is much tougher than theirs. Then, you know, it can be a wee bit more difficult, but the same question comes down to the same question. You know, asking yourself, what can I do? How can I tackle this situation? You know, even though it's harder than it is for other people, how can I get through this? You know, it's basically just asking ourselves these questions. How can I get through it? You know, you might find you'll have to do things differently from other people, it's much more difficult. I mean, I've had some really challenging situations myself, you know, in my life. I mean, when I was at school, high school, I was bullied tremendous, you know, horribly in my final year at high school. And that was a very, very stressful situation, to the extent that I really did not want to go to school, you know. But you're in a position where you don't have a choice. You've actually just got to go. And I kind of wish I knew now, I knew then some of the things that I knew now. You know, I maybe would have done things a wee bit differently from how I did.
Sorry, Gunnar.
Oh, no. But you know, probably what I would have tried to do there was, you know, work more on myself. You know, I would have practiced, again, as touchy-feely as it sounds, I would have practiced meditation a lot, because meditation, I found over the years, gives you a greater sense of control, a greater sense of positivity, you know, a greater sense of well-being, I suppose, that even when things are tough, you just start to develop an inner feeling that I can find a way through this.
Okay, well, we're going to talk about meditation shortly. I mean, really coming back onto the rough environment. I mean, the places, a couple of places I grew up in, absolutely very rough. And if you were kind, you'd probably get beat up just for being kind.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure how you deal with that. What about people who grew up in hostile environments? It might be hostile because of their gender. It might be hostile because of their financial condition.
Yeah.
So maybe it might be a childhood thing. And they're now grown adults and they get all this. But then this past experience keeps coming back to haunt them. Can they create any changes from within, you know, biochemically, which will help them?
Absolutely. I mean, being in a hostile environment doesn't mean that you have to be hostile back. You know, the key thing in all of this is irrespective of another person's behaviour, it's your behaviour that influences your own health. So even if you're in a hostile environment, providing you're not hostile back, if you can find a way of dealing with situations that doesn't involve you raising your voice, for example, or becoming aggressive or fighting in any respect, then you're not having the same kind of effect. I mean, sometimes even raising your stress levels is quite a healthy thing, but that's more of an aside. But overall, you know, just tackling any environment with, you know, that question, you know, what is the best thing that I can do in this situation that can keep me healthiest without kind of losing myself, so to speak.
Okay, so you mentioned about meditation. What else can people do to detach themselves away from?
I actually meant to say that. Yeah, there's a number of kind of exercises that people can actually do. One of them, you know, again, I suppose kind of touchy-feely as it might sound, psychologists call this a gratitude intervention, and it's a way of gradually changing how you feel, not only about situations but about people, about many, many different aspects of life. And what you have to do is, just in your own private moments, is you either write down or you just do it in your own head, is you maybe make a list of 5 to 10 things that you're grateful for that happened in the last 24 hours. And as silly and simple as that might sound, what eventually begins to happen when you do it over a period of time is you start to notice and find yourself paying attention to more of the better stuff in life and less of the painful stuff. And what that begins to do is, because you're focusing on different things, it begins to tilt the biochemistry of the body, because the biochemistry of the body is actually responding to what you're paying attention to, or not so much what you're paying attention to, but what you're feeling about the things that you pay attention to. And over a period of time, you gradually find yourself being more optimistic, in a real sense, feeling better, feeling emotionally better. Gratitude interventions and some studies are producing comparable results to Prozac for people who are experiencing mild to moderate depression. And
right, okay. So you mentioned meditation a number of times, and that's something I espouse. What are the mechanics of meditation? What actually happens specifically when someone meditates? You know,
when someone meditates, there's a number of different types of meditation, but regardless of what type a person does, one of the major things that happens is the rhythms of the heart begin to change. in a very, very positive way. And your heart begins to produce nitric oxide, which I mentioned earlier, and nitric oxide dilates the artery. So this is why meditation can have such a good impact on the heart. Initially, that's one of its major effects. Now, meditation has a massive impact on the brain as well. And many studies show now that meditation actually, in fact, to quote some of the neuroscience journals, offsets neural decline caused by the aging process. What that means is as we age, some parts of the brain, particularly the part above your eyes called the prefrontal cortex, that part begins to decline in thickness in much the same way as a muscle does. So if a person is exercising a muscle, then the muscle begins to grow and it becomes more dense. If a person stops exercising that muscle, over a period of time, the muscle becomes thinner and thinner and thinner. Now, the same happens with the brain, and neuroscientists often use this as an analogy that the brain is like a muscle, that if you don't exercise it, then it begins to decline, and that's why these brain trainer devices are so popular at the moment. But what happens with the prefrontal cortex, this part above the eyes, is over as we age, that part gets thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner. You know, really, pretty much year on year, it becomes thinner and thinner. Now, it doesn't have to become thinner as fast as it does. It's just because the average person doesn't use their brain as much as they did when they were, say, let's say, 18 or 20 years old. But what meditation does is it offsets that. And what it means is it slows down the decline. And you'll find that in many studies, the average person in, let's say, who's 50 to 60 years old, who's been meditating regularly for, let's say, 10 or 15 years, then they actually have a thicker prefrontal cortex than most 20-year-olds. In other words, instead of the muscle declining, it's actually got thicker and thicker. So their brain, in that sense, is actually healthier and more active, more dense with connections than the average 20-year-old. So meditation's having this powerfully, powerfully positive effect on the brain. And the third thing that happens to... Oh, sorry, were you going to...
No, go ahead. I love it.
Yeah, the third major discovery in meditation was only made by Harvard just over 18 months ago. And Harvard found that for a group of people who were novice meditators, who didn't really meditate, who were taught to meditate and given a simple meditation to do, you know, 20 minutes a day for 8 weeks, they impacted 1,561 of their genes. Now, that is a phenomenal study. Because what it shows is meditation has genetic impacts. And what that's actually meaning is if you picture your genes as little light bulbs, I often use this analogy, picture your genes as Christmas tree lights, and we've got 25,000 genes, so 25,000 light bulbs. And they flash on and off in seemingly random patterns throughout the day. What the study at Harvard found is meditation was directly impacting 1,561 of them. The overall effect of that was better health, and a slowing down of the aging process.
Okay, so the biggie is the aging process, because I actually, you know, without sounding like I'm bragging, but I actually look very young for my age.
I get complimented.
Yeah, we met. I get complimented all the time.
I was stunned to see you when I thought you looked much. I thought you were much younger than you were.
That's right. I don't know if it's a meditation or if it's something else, but I tell you what, I do actually meditate. Please explain a bit more about aging, because aging seems to be a big issue.
Yeah.
For people, particularly women, you know, I mean, there's aging conferences that go on, so obviously there's a big industry there. The makeup, you know, the cosmetics industry is big on that. So please explain a bit more about the aging process and meditation.
Well, meditation counteracts the aging process in a number of ways, but one of the quick things that happen is it reduces blood pressure. And having high blood pressure is associated with, you know, faster aging. But another thing that meditation does is it produces nitric oxide. And I've mentioned this a few times already. But nitric oxide, in the sense that not having enough nitric oxide is also associated with aging of the body. In fact, not having enough nitric oxide is known by scientists as one of the major agers. In other words, there's a handful of things which are major agers, and not having enough nitric oxide is a major ager, right? And it, basically that contributes to the muscle tone, if you like, of your veins, arteries, and capillaries. So in the sense, if a person exercises a muscle, they get muscle tone. then vascular tone is the equivalent in the inside of your veins, arteries and capillaries. And vascular tone is related to the amount of nitric oxide we have. So you can see the comparison. If you don't have enough muscle tone, then your muscle's wasting, then your muscle's aging, if you like. It's not as young and healthy. So the same is, it's happened the same inside your blood vessels, your veins, arteries and capillaries. So meditation directly impacts vascular tone in that respect. But one of the things that the Harvard study found with when they examined some of the genes is some of the genes that were switched off, the light bulbs that were switched off, were producing stress hormones in the body. Now, stress hormones are also one of the agers of the body. So by reducing stress hormone levels, meditation was directly slowing the aging process. Now, what it was also doing was producing, some of the genes switched on were producing natural antioxidants. Now, what an antioxidant does is it acts like a little sponge, and it sponges up the free radicals in the body. Now, free radicals, again, is another one of the major agers, and most people are now aware that we take antioxidants to counteract free radicals, because free radicals age the body. In fact, they play a big role in causing wrinkles in the face. That's why a lot of anti-wrinkle creams, one of the things they're trying to do is counteract free radicals. So free radicals is a major ager, but free radical levels are reduced directly, again, by meditation. So meditation has tremendous anti-aging effects. I've even been known to say on a few occasions, meditation might just be better than Botox.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
If you do it regularly.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, meditation means a lot of things to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And having tried but one of the big issues that a lot of people have mentioned is, oh, I don't have enough time to meditate, or I don't know how to meditate. So can you explain, in your opinion, what you mean by meditation in your definition?
Well, there's a number of different techniques. But one of the simplest techniques of meditation is just to sit and breathe. But you breathe on purpose. And again, it's so simple. But all you actually do is go, and you breathe on purpose. Now, on purpose, contrary to what most people breathe like, most people are not even aware that they're breathing. And if you suddenly catch yourself breathing, you realize you're not breathing at all. And most people are fully exhaled most of the time. But when you breathe on purpose, just taking regular breaths, like in for a count of four and out for a count of four. And doing that regularly, let's say for 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes, is one of the simplest forms of meditation. And it has some of these direct physiological effects on the body. Now, there's variations of that. There's types of meditation where you become mindful, like a mindfulness meditation, where you might become mindful of your surroundings. So you're not trying to block out any sounds. You're not particularly trying to focus on breathing. You're just becoming aware of sounds around you. You might become aware even of how your bum feels when it's sitting on the chair. But you're not putting labels on things. You're not saying, oh, if a bus goes past, oh, that is a bus going past. You're just aware of the sound, and then you let it go. So you're becoming mindful of your surroundings. But again, it's a very powerful form of meditation. You have the forms where you might wish, you might contemplate spiritual ideas. It's a type of meditation I do sometimes, and I ask myself the question, who am I? You know, what is my connection with consciousness? What is consciousness? What is the nature of reality? You know, is there a supreme spiritual being? Is this part of me? Am I part of that? And I ask myself these probing spiritual questions. Another meditation form is when you might, I've described it slightly earlier, you might just wish happiness, well-being and compassion on a range of different people. But the whole point of meditation is you're doing something repetitively. You know, so whatever type you're doing, you're actually focusing upon something, which drowns out of your mind that focusing on all the other things, like what you have to do with shopping, the fact you've got, you know, 15 emails to reply to and a phone call you've got to make. And we're not thinking of all the different things that we're supposed to do in our life. We're in fact focused upon something in particular. And that's the power of meditation. It's a singular focus upon an intent or upon, you know, a breathing pattern or something like that. It's a singularity of focus.
Is there a, you know, average duration where you think, well, this is an optimal time to meditate? Because some people I know meditate for hours, and for myself, for example, occasionally I do. I'll meditate for maybe initially 30 minutes, and I might just do another 30 for good measure. Sometimes I'll do it twice a day. But, I mean, initially when I started off, I mean, I could barely get 5 minutes in. So is there a good optimal time where it really has, you know, starts having a powerful effect on your body?
Some of the scientific studies are pointing towards this kind of, at the moment, you know, 20 minutes a day seems to be what some of the studies are finding real optimum benefits. In fact, even studies where they teach meditation as part of a caring program for women with breast cancer. Again, they're applying 20 minutes of that. I don't think it's because they found 20 minutes as an optimum. I think they just started with 20 minutes. But for people who find it difficult, when I first started to meditate, I agree with you entirely. I struggled to do 5 minutes. In fact, for me, I struggled to do 2 minutes, and I felt really restless in what am I doing. But what happens is with practice, meditation begins to impact that front part of the brain. And as it impacts that front part of the brain, you become better at doing it. And you can then sit for longer and longer time. So it's like working a muscle. The stronger the muscle gets, you know, the more you can use it, the more you can lift with it. And the same is true with meditation. The more you do it, the better the effects are. But universally, there is always physiological benefits. I think even if a person did 5 minutes a day, there would be healthy physiological benefits. The compassion meditation I described earlier, scientists observed substantial dropping in inflammation within the body with a 20-minute meditation session per day. So that it wasn't so much that was an optimum. They didn't particularly test 10 minutes, and they didn't particularly test half an hour, but they definitely found in 20 minutes there was significant drops in inflammation within the body.
You know, one thing I'm going to do, because I'm where I'm based at the Oracy, which is absolutely a fantastic center, research center, which is about to launch, I'm going to actually commission a study on some of these techniques and processes, scientifically commission it, because I really think it's those people who are already converted and practicing, well, they don't need any more convincing.
Yeah.
But they're, given, I do believe that meditation is no longer an option, it's a must. You know, because of the effect it's had on me, its effects I've had on my clients. I do a lot of work with young people from socially disadvantaged areas who get involved in violence and stress and crime. And just a small amount of meditation and the breathing that goes with it, wow, the phenomenal change they see. So I do believe it's,
you know, one of the things that I often use to really convince people, I don't know if you're aware, you've heard of it, it's called an EM wave by a company called HeartMath.
Oh, yes, yeah, I know HeartMath, yeah.
And I often use that as a kind of teaching device where you can actually see the rhythms of your heart on the computer screen when your pulse has been monitored. And to see people's faces change when you teach them a simple meditation, and literally within 10 seconds, they can actually see live on the screen a change to the rhythms of their heart. And it's absolutely phenomenal. And I found, especially in a business environment, it's a major convincer to people about the powers of meditation, because you show them their heart rhythms before they do the meditation, and they look, most of the time, measuring heart rhythms in a particular way, they look like the Richter scale before an earthquake.
Yes, but yes, I've seen it.
Within 10, maybe even 20 seconds of meditation, they have this beautiful sine wave, a beautiful up and down rhythmic wave, and it's flabbergasting to many people to see that transformation in their own heart within just 10, 20 seconds.
So you mentioned the word compassion, which is I think is a very beautiful and powerful word. But what do you actually mean by compassion?
For me, compassion is, in a sense, it's an extension of sympathy. You know, we feel sympathy, you empathize with someone. You know, empathy, I guess the definition is, I feel with you, I'm with you, I'm sharing your pain. But compassion, we move slightly beyond that, and we move beyond just feeling with them, and we feel for them. Compassion actually is defined as I feel for you, as opposed to empathy, which is I feel with you. Compassion, you're actually now actively wishing them freedom from suffering. You're moving beyond I'm sharing your pain to now I want your pain to go away. Right?
Right.
So for me, that's what compassion is. It's part of the I'm with you in this, I'm feeling it, and then you're shifting towards, and now I want it to go away for you. I want you, the pain to be disappeared from your life. So that's
so. So can you re-emphasize, I mean, why compassion, I mean, the effects of compassion on the mind, the body, etc., so to our listeners, so that they really, we can drum it home here.
Yeah, well, the major impact, the major, singular major impact of compassion is reduction in inflammation within the body. Now, inflammation is a primary cause of many forms of heart disease. It's a primary cause of some forms of cancer. It plays a massive role in the aging process. Massive, in fact, so much so that some gerontologists, a gerontologist is a scientist who studies the aging process, and some gerontologists have said that if they could find a drug that would counteract the effects of inflammation in the body, the human body is easily able to live to 150 years old. But it's the inflammation that causes the deterioration of the body. Now, compassion substantially reduces inflammation in the body, and that's a very, very recent discovery. Very, very recent discovery.
Well, when you say a significant, you know, effect on inflammation, or can you give numbers, percentages?
Let me think. One of the recent studies using the compassion meditation, some people who did no meditation at all, and I've got a picture of the graph in my mind, I forget the individual levels, but the difference between the people who had done no meditation versus the people who had done about 20 minutes a day was about 50-75%. So the people who had done the compassion meditations after just a six-week study had about 50 to 75% less inflammation in their body.
Whoa, really?
That's just me taking the I can see the graph in my mind because I've...
Even if it was anywhere near 50%, that's a massive
shift. It's quite a sharp... you know, in a standard graph, you have a slope. It was quite a sharp slope. I would say the gradient was probably, you know, greater than 1 to 1.
Okay, so we're going to talk a bit more about that in a moment. Well, what I'd like to do is, first of all, is your book. I mean, when somebody buys your book, and by the way, listeners, if you do want to buy David's book, if you're listening on the web right now, all you do is go on to the link, which is more about Dr. David Hamilton, and click on the link, and it'll take you to his website. And his website is, if I'm correct, drdavidhamilton.com, and you can get all his books there, including the topic we're talking about, which is why kindness is good for you. David, what will people expect to read in that particular book, other than what we've talked about?
A number of studies shown how kindness improves happiness levels. How kindness and gratitude can be a very good antidote to depression, to let's say mild and moderate depression. I have a lot of research on oxytocin and how it actually reduces the levels of free radicals and inflammation in the body. I have a chapter on forgiveness as well and the health benefits of forgiveness. There's also a large section on why babies need love, and shown how a baby's brain grows and develops over the first 2 years of its life, and how a positive, warm, kind, and nurturing environment it catalyzes that growth. And then if a baby's brought up in an environment where a young child is brought up in an environment that's lacking in love and kindness and compassion and even human contact, then the effect is often an underdeveloped brain, particularly in the frontal area. So I showed all of the book contains a chapter with all of that research.
So going back to what you talked about, just on that topic about underdeveloped frontal lobe, then what you're saying is they're going to be more dependent or working their amygdala much more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
they're going to be higher up. Yeah. The fear-based emotions of anger.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, Harun. Yeah, definitely more activity, more fear and anxiety and mistrustful. Usually what you often find is a lack of social skills compared with people who have a very well-developed frontal, you know, prefrontal cortex or frontal lobes.
So what you've described, I mean, I'm talking about the young people who I mentor quite often. What you've described is really, you know, this ghetto situation where, you know, you get young people who are mistrusting, a lot of anger, a lot of hatred, a lot of crime. Actually, you don't have to grow up in that kind of area to have those kind of feelings of anxiety. You can brought up in a very good environment, well-to-do environment, highly educated, a lot of money, but with no love, you have the same consequences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without adequate amounts of love and kindness and responsiveness of the parent, responsive to the needs of the child growing up, and warm human contact, you know, like physical touch, you know, hugs, you know, just contact, skin to skin contact. All of these things are absolutely necessary. They're vital, in fact, for the healthy growth of a child's brain.
My goodness. So in the last closing minutes, we've got about 10 minutes left. We talked about meditation, kindness. I mean, kindness and compassion. How can somebody bring more kindness and compassion into their life in several easy steps? What are the top tips that you can give, David?
Two main tips I say to people is just try to be more kind. When you say an option to be kind, do it. But what you have to do here is keep a diary for a short period of time. And what the diary does is it causes you to focus on kindness. So you make a diary of the types of things that you've done. It might be just you picked a pen up for someone who dropped a pen. You lent someone a book, or you bought someone a present. You took someone for coffee. You paid someone a compliment. You said thank you for something. You don't have to be changing someone's life. You just have to be doing these small acts. But if you keep a diary of it, what the diary does is it causes you to focus on it, and you remember to do more acts of kindness. So it really helps to tilt your focus in the direction of kindness. The second thing I actually challenge people with is I say, see if you could go 21 days while performing an act of kindness every day. I call this my 21-day kindness challenge. So do at least a minimum of one act of kindness every single day for 21 days. And notice the difference in people's lives when you do it. Notice the smiles in people's faces, but you'll find yourself becoming much happier. At the end of it, you'll feel better. Now, you're not doing the kindness to feel happier and better. You're doing the acts of kindness because we know it's the right thing to do. But the benefits you get are side effects, but they're very welcome side effects. That's my two major things, is keep a diary, but also try a 21-day kindness challenge, because then you have something to aim for. You say, okay, I'm starting tomorrow, and what's 21 days from that? Okay, that's my start, that's my finish. Here we go, and you do something every day.
So you mentioned during the workshop I was at something about when somebody's harsh or critical, you need to do certain acts of kindness to actually make up for it. Did I hear that correctly?
Say that again, sorry.
So say, for example, if I said something horrible to you, to make up for it, I'd have to say, four or five things nice to you to make up for it. Would that be correct?
Yeah. One of these studies, what they were finding, they were looking at people's overall levels of, I guess, well-being, emotional well-being. And what they found is for a person to be generally feeling a good sense of well-being, or even call it happy, if you like, then they had to have a positivity ratio of at least 3-1. And what that means is for every negative way of thinking, every period of negative thinking or negative speaking or pessimistic thinking or speaking they have, then they should be having at least 3 times the number of positive thinking or speaking. And what you find is if that ratio is about 3-1, then you find people tend to have a good overall sense of mental and emotional well-being. In relationships, it's actually 5-1. And studies about, there's a very eminent scientist, a psychologist called John Gottman, and he discovered that the average positivity ratio in a happy marriage or a happy relationship is 5-1. You know, in other words, for every one negative thought you have about your partner, then for a relationship to be really healthy and happy, then you tend to find that those unhealthy and happy relationships drown out the effects of one negative with 5 positives. And so it's very, very similar. So for a general person, just in their general life, then for every negative pattern of thinking, every negative thought, then those who tend to be happiest in life tend to have 3 times as many positives. So if you do find yourself in a negative pattern of thinking or speaking, then try to catch yourself, take a breath to interrupt the pattern, just go, okay, I caught myself there, and then try to entertain something positive. For as well, it doesn't mean be afraid of your negative thinking, but just when you do catch them, just become aware of what your overall ratio might be.
There is a thing that have, which is quite predominant, I suppose, across cultures, which is that given a choice between a compliment and a criticism, it seems to be that we hold on to criticism, the negative, more. So if somebody gave you compliments, you know, generally most people hold on to the one criticism that was made. So maybe it's a cultural thing, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think you're probably right with that, because you know, I'm liable to do the same myself. You know, someone pays you a compliment and you forget about it a minute later. You just kind of, thanks, it's okay. But someone makes a criticism and it's like a mortal wound. You know,
yes.
you're still talking about it a week later.
Yes.
You know, and I think it is. You know, negative things towards us can hurt. You know, they're really painful. You know, I think it is a kind of cultural thing. You know?
Absolutely. Gary, one of our listeners, Gary Plunkett from Chester, says, I had four ladies from Preston tell me that their rheumatism and arthritis went away completely when they did just 30 minutes of Hawaiian Huna Ha breathing technique per day.
Wow.
So, you know, he appreciates the anecdotal from a scientific point of view. Is there anything you can say to that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually, it's quite common, actually, arthritis and rheumatism. So these kind of things respond very, very well to meditation, principally because these conditions are negatively affected by inflammation in the body. So through meditation, you begin to reduce inflammation. So the absolute rapid byproduct of that is having less inflammation, as you have less rheumatic pain or less arthritic pain. That's why these type of conditions respond very, very fast and very effectively to meditation.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, it's all starting to make sense now.
Yeah.
The challenge would be, of course, if somebody's got arthritis, rheumatism, and they're very aged, or, you know, old generation, to actually convince them that this may be of benefit to them.
Yeah.
Rather than being reliant on 50 drugs that they take a day.
And it doesn't mean that they have to stop doing anything else that they're doing. You just try this as well and notice what the benefits that you get are.
We've only got three more minutes. Is there any wisdom you want to share with us? Because, you know, I mean, what you talked about today is absolutely phenomenal. You know, the whole concept of kindness and compassion in the workplace, in just general life, is absolutely phenomenal. Well, what else would you like to say about that, which really, you know, get it home for our listeners?
For me, it's all about just, I love the word gentleness. It's just about being gentle, you know, being gentle in your attitudes towards people. But, you know, and don't ever forget ourselves. Be gentle towards yourself. Self-compassion is something that we completely forget about. And what that means is taking time out for yourself, treating yourself the way that you would expect to treat other people. In other words, turn that gentleness in on yourself, you know, but have a gentle attitude. You know, just in the way that you think about people, in your attitude towards people, be patient and be willing to see, willing to empathize with people, and be willing to see the don't jump to conclusions. In other words, you know, we all jump to conclusions with people's behavior. We say that person did that because of, and we don't always know the full story. So I'm always very open minded and being patient enough to wait for people to wait to see the real cause of something, but just don't jump to conclusions with people. That's part of being gentle in your attitude towards people, because you never know why a person does what they do, but what you can control is your attitude towards them. I think these small things, just your gentleness towards people, have substantial benefits to your overall health of your mind, how you feel mentally, emotionally, but also the health of your physical body as well. But gentleness is how I would sum up the whole thing.
Okay, thank you. And if people wanted to find out more about you, or actually want to see you live, which is absolutely beautiful, by the way, I mean, love your presentations.
No, thank you.
What's the best way to get in touch with you? I mean,
my website, which you've mentioned, that I'm also on Facebook and Twitter. So
right, okay. So Facebook, Twitter, and your website, which is drdavidhamilton.com.
Yeah, and there's links to Facebook, my Facebook and Twitter pages on my website.
Brilliant. Well, David, you've been an absolute phenomenal guest. Thank you very much for sharing this wonderful research and the wisdom behind, you know, what you're talking about and the implications of it. That's absolutely great.
Thank
now,
you.
For any for those regular listeners, in 2 weeks' time, we have another interview, and this is with an amazing individual who is going to be talking about energy and energy coaching. I've done some work with this man himself, and he is absolutely amazing. Make sure you're there. David, thank you very much for coming on the show. And listeners, we shall speak very soon. Take care.
Thank you very much. Have a nice night.
And you. Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye.